Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Coming up on episode 254 of Wheel Bearings, we've got the new Kia Sportage Hybrid and Nissan Altima all-wheel drive, Ford Bronco Everglades running through the muck, Hyundai Ioniq 6, no more buying out your Ford EV leases, and touchscreens almost killing drivers at Pike's Peak, and a conversation with Jack Hollis. All that and more coming up next. Did you know you can support Wheel Bearings directly? Head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia and you can become a patron today. Your contributions will help fund the platforms and tools we use to bring the podcast to you. And exclusives and improvements are already on the way thanks to your generosity. So if you want to be part of an automotive podcast like no other, head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia. This is episode 254 of Wheel Bearings. I'm Sam Abuel Samage from Guidehouse Insights.
And I am Roberto Baldwin from Reviewed.com.
Ooh, that's a new one.
I've done some stuff for them. None of it's like been automotive, but I am doing some folding electric bicycles for them.
Oh, right, cool. Now.
So my garage there, fortunately, they're not sending me 10 bikes at once. I'm getting like a set of three, and then a set of four. So... But I was like, yeah, let's give them some love. And, you know, if you're getting an electric car, get an electric bike. And you ride it around. They're fun.
And Nicole says she's running late from the world's slowest dimmer, which I'm assuming is a typo, and she meant dinner. Start without me and I'll jump in. So she will join us in progress.
It's just slowly getting darker.
It might well be a slow dimmer. Who knows?
The world's slowest dimmer. She's like, I can't see.
She
it's
wants
turning
to stay
the
in the light ahead
high.
Of the dimmer.
Yeah.
So we'll see when she gets here.
We'll see. Dinner or dimmer. Let's make our bets now.
All right. So you had nothing to drive this week.
I have driven nothing.
Nothing. Just some folding electric bikes. Which
just some folding electric bikes.
I mean, if you want to talk about one of them, you can. But
I rode it down the street and back because there's a big hill. Uh-huh. And I just wanted to see like with one of them if they could get me up the hill. In a reasonable fashion, because it's pretty steep, and it did. So that's all I've done, because I went out, and then I ended up talking to my neighbor for 30 minutes.
Okay. Well, I had the 2023 Kia Sportage Hybrid SX Prestige all-wheel drive, another overly extended name. So this is the new Sportage. And the Sportage is – oh, there she is. The Sportage is the last original nameplate from Kia when Kia first launched in the North American market. They launched back in the mid-90s with the Sportage and a little sedan called the Cephea. And, well, neither one of them were particularly – well, I would say the Sportage was memorable but in all the wrong ways, that first generation. I had a chance to drive one on a test track. The company I was working for at the time actually was doing the ABS for it. And, boy, that was a scary car. But this is not. This is a much better vehicle. And this new generation of Sportage has gotten substantially larger than the old one. The old one, you know, was on the small side of compact crossovers. And this one is very much, you know, on the larger end, you know, similar in size to the RAV4 and CR-V and other stuff. Very roomy. It's got the same hybrid powertrain that's in the Sorento with the 1.6 liter turbo and electric motor, and a battery under the back seat. The design, you know, it's a pretty substantially different design from the previous generation, and it doesn't really look much like any other current Kias. Probably the closest thing to it would be the EV6, but even that is quite a bit different. In its design direction. So it'll be interesting to see where Kia goes from here with their design. But you know, in most respects, you know, it's a pretty conventional, you know, compact crossover. You know, it's like, aside from big pickup trucks, you know, it's the strongest segment in the U.S. market now. It has taken over from the likes of the Camry and Accord and Altima as the top sellers. The hybrid system in here, you know, I've always liked the Hyundai Kia hybrid system in terms of, you know, the way they feel when you're driving. They feel the most normal of hybrids. You know, they're pretty seamless when it's shifting back and forth between electric and hybrid and engine on modes. There's none of the motorboating effect you get from the CVT hybrids like the Fords and the Toyotas. But one thing I was a little disappointed with was the fuel economy. The front wheel drive Sportage hybrid is rated at 43 miles per gallon combined. The all wheel drive is rated at 38. I only got about 31.5, which is the farthest I've fallen short of, you know, the label value in a long time, especially for a hybrid. And, you know, I've driven a number of other, you know, contemporary Hyundai and Kia hybrids. And, you know, they've all done substantially better than this one. And I'm not sure why this one did so relatively poorly. I mean, you know, not that almost 32 miles per gallon is terrible, but it's certainly not what I was expecting from this vehicle. I was expecting something in the upper 30s. So you know, other stuff, you know, the interior, you know, obviously a lot roomier than the old Sportage, or Sportage, as we should perhaps call it.
Sportage.
The infotainment, you know, it's the same kind of evolution of the Hyundai Kia system that we've been seeing on some other models like the EV6, including the strip along below the center touchscreen. And this was something that I had initially had a challenge with on the EV6. It's actually a dual mode touch panel with a couple of knobs on it. So,
it does take a little bit to get used to it.
Yeah. So one mode is climate control. And so if you want to adjust the defogger or the temperature or anything else like that, you know, you turn and twist the knobs. There's a knob on the left, one on the right. Twist the knobs to adjust your temperatures, turn on the rear, front and rear window defoggers, things like that. And when I drove the EV6, when I first got into it, it was in the climate control mode. And I went to twist the knob to adjust the radio volume, and it kept turning up the temperature. And I couldn't figure out how to get it to volume mode. And I ended up, you know, just using the control on the steering wheel. And that's the one I drove to Elkhart Lake for the Mama Spring Rally. And I talked to James Bell from Kia there, and he showed me how to do it. There's actually one of the buttons on there. There's a little fan icon and an arrow icon. And when you tap that, it toggles back and forth. So if you go to the arrow version, it gives you media controls. So the temperature knobs become volume and tuning knobs. And the labels change on there, and the labels across the touch strip change. So you now have labels for navigation and media and assorted other stuff. So it's kind of an odd system. Once you figure out, you know, that you have to go back and forth, it works okay. But I'd rather just have dedicated stuff for things like that.
It's a cross between what JLR has done with the steering wheel, where it's contextual. You, like, uh-huh, as you do things on the lights on the steering wheel turn to, they become different different controls, and what Volkswagen has when it comes to its front and rear window thing with the ID4. It's not nearly as bad as that. It's not quite as nice as the Jaguar thing.
Yeah.
I think what most people are going to end up doing is just leaving it on climate control and doing the volume with the steering wheel.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. That probably makes more sense. But when I went somewhere with my wife, she wanted to adjust the volume, and it was in climate control mode. And so I said, see if you can figure out how to adjust the volume.
And you definitely have to be told. You have to be told what it does.
Yeah, she, you know, like, at least like myself, she was not able to figure it out without somebody telling her how to do it. So, let's see what else. Oh, the the Highway Drive Assist feature. So this is something that, you know, is on most new Kias and Hyundais and Genesis models. This is their combination of adaptive cruise control and lane centering functionality. And, you know, after having driven the Rivian just the other week, and, you know, that one has essentially the same function, you know, lane centering control and adaptive cruise control. They have 11 cameras on the Rivian and 5 radar sensors. The Kia has one camera, one front radar sensor. There's a couple of rear radar sensors that use it for blind spot monitoring. The Kia did a lot better job of keeping the car centered in the lane. And, you know, when you're going through corners, not wanting to drift outwards, you know, just staying locked in the center of the lane. It's a hands-on system, unlike Super Cruise that I'm driving now. But it does a great job. I mean, you can just kind of keep your hands right by the wheel, just enough to give it just enough resistance so that it thinks your hands are there. But it will track down the road beautifully. It does a really, really good job. And then the only kind of dynamic complaint I have about it, there's a few spots along I-94 and the near Detroit Metro Airport where there's a transition from the main pavement to a bridge overpass and back again, where there's kind of a little bit of a drop and come back up. And I think the Sportage feels like it could use a little bit better rebound damping when it's coming up, because it kind of comes up a little bit too far when it bounces back. And, you know, and then when it comes back down, the dampers kind of lock it down better. But just when it's coming up, it gives it a little bit too much bounce. But other than that, you know, the ride quality is great. It's, you know, fairly quiet. And then, you know, just the kind of somewhat underwhelming fuel economy.
Weird.
Yeah. So the Sportage Hybrid starts at $27,290 for the front-wheel drive LX model. The one I had was the SX Prestige with all-wheel drive. So that's fully loaded with all the goodies, and, you know, the usual Android Auto and Apple CarPlay, 18-inch wheels. This one had the Shadow Matte Gray finish, which Ooh. Looks quite good on this particular shape. Panoramic sunroof and Harman Kardon premium audio, LED fog lights, all the good stuff, and then some. And this one came out to a grand total of $38,000 even, including the $1,215 destination charge. So that is the 2023 Kia Sportage SX Prestige all-wheel drive hybrid, which it needs to be condensed.
Kia Sportage Hyperprestige all-wheel drive.
And as I've been doing my little monologue here, Nicole has joined us. Hello, Nicole.
Hey, sorry about that.
we were discussing before your arrival.
Yes.
Were you in fact running from the world's slowest dimmer, trying to stand the light, or was it a slow dinner?
I didn't say dimmer. It was actually. See, you can tell. I gotta text Sam. I'm not gonna make it in time. it was really? The world's slowest dinner. Unfortunately,
that makes, I guess, more sense.
Yeah.
Whatever.
One of our favorite restaurants that is normally super speedy, quick, and I'm like, so of course today they weren't. I'm like, you guys, I've got a podcast. So, apologies.
Come on. Come on, you guys.
You guys.
So what have you been driving, Nicole?
I am in the 2022 Nissan Altima 2.5 SR all-wheel drive. I don't know. Is that longer than your Kia Sportage?
Altima SR all-wheel drive. Wait, was there another one?
Because I had hybrid and SX Prestige as well.
There's a bunch of stuff in there.
Shoot, I was, dang it. So, you know, sedans, which aren't the most popular of cars these days, but this is a decent sedan. It has a 2.5 liter four-cylinder engine, 182 horsepower, 178 pound-feet of torque. You're not going to win any races in this. It's not super aggressive, but it's competent. Like accelerating on the highway, which I was aggressively doing to get here to record this podcast, I had no problem getting right up to speed. And it handled well, yeah, just zoom right up there. So it's a nice car, and it's quiet. It, you know, sedans are about just kind of nicely taking people where they need to go. Their focus isn't off-roading. Their focus isn't on cargo. Their focus is people. Excuse me. And this one does a good job of that. It's very comfortable. It's very quiet, nice and easy to drive, but still responsive enough that you feel like, you know, you're, it's not lackluster. It has plenty of performance for what you're getting. It is a $31,440 car. So it's not an outrageously expensive car. It's a nicely priced choice.
And it's also not outrageously affordable either.
No, but I mean, for what you're getting, I mean, this also is
this is the all-wheel drive version though, right?
Yeah.
And it's their Midnight Edition, which is something that's available on the SR trim. You can't get this on the other trims. And the Midnight Edition adds, it's like $1,700, and it adds LED fog lights, heated front seats. There's power driver lumbar support, a sliding moonroof. You get a fancy blacked out stuff. You get a Midnight Edition badge on the back.
Well, that's worth $1,700.
That alone is worth $100. And you get heated outside mirrors with LED turn signal indicators.
Ooh. Well, you know, those heated mirrors can actually be very handy in the wintertime.
Yeah, actually, when it's all iced up and you're just like, no.
Because
I forgot to scrape off the mirrors.
Well, it's not even that. If you live someplace where it snows, you could have scraped off that stupid mirror. And if the snow is the right miraculous consistency of water and ice and cold temperatures, and it just builds up, and you're like, I could see out that side mirror when this trip started. And
yep.
With snow and gravity. Then you're like trying to roll down your window and take that off, and you're either going on the highway going like 59 miles an hour, and now you're getting snow in your face, or you're trying to do it in a stoplight, freezing to like, I gotta get this cleaned off before I start going again. So heated side mirrors are actually kind of cool. So nice, comfortable car, easily seats five. I mean, there's no problem putting three adults in the back of this. It's not something you necessarily want a road trip with three adults in the back, but it's very comfortable for shorter drives. And for two adults, yeah, totally could. There was, again, 6-foot husband and 8-year-old daughter sitting behind each other, totally enough room for everybody. So that's my test for whether grown-ups can actually be comfortable in this car. Like, again, I say, I don't know about Robbie because Robbie's a giant, but average grown-ups could be because he's a giant. You also get a whole bunch of driver assist features that are standard on this. There's rear automatic braking, blind spot warning, rear cross traffic alert, lane departure, sort of the usual suspects on this. And it does have it has an attractive interior. You get a leather wrapped steering wheel. You get a leather wrapped shift knob. There's an 8-way power driver seat. It looks nice inside. Like, it doesn't feel like a cheap car. It actually looks a little nicer than what the price tag is, honestly. Like, for $31,000, you're getting a really decent looking car. I like how it looks. And you get a decent amount of tech with that, too. You have an 8-inch color touchscreen. There's Apple CarPlay and Android Auto, which is nice. You know, there's 6-speaker audio systems. So, it's not like you've got some fancy 24-speaker Bose premium whatever, but you have a nice, decent audio system. You have a nice, decent infotainment system that's easy to use. It's pretty intuitive. I think the system that Nissan uses does not take a long time to get the hang of. It has a nice, responsive touchscreen. So I like this. I've driven this sedan. It's funny. I drove this in a while back, and it with all-wheel drive during literally I saw it was like a blizzard that like descended upon me as I landed at the airport and had like a 1-hour drive home. And it was like, well, it's either sleep at the airport Hilton or get in the car and drive home. And I drove it home. And I got to say, this handles amazingly well in the snow, because the thing with like all-wheel drive is great, but part of a sedan problem too, if you're driving in rough weather, it doesn't matter how good your all-wheel drive is. If your snow is too deep and if you're driving over sort of those little berms created by the snowplows, you'll just bottom out and you're done and you're stuck. And this got through a lot of it. It handled really well. There was a lot of snow on the road. So even though today it's nice and beautiful and sunny, I have driven this in the snow, and this was one of my favorite vehicles to have to drive, as sedans go, to have to take through crummy weather. So if you want a nice, comfortable sedan that's not outrageously priced, that looks good, feels good, has good acceleration, and yeah, you can drive in the snow because I did it, this is definitely one to consider. I'm really a fan of this one. I like the Altima.
Cool. And of course, this is the one weekend a year that you don't have snow in New Hampshire, right?
Right. The one. It's just this weekend. The rest of them snow all the time.
okay, cool. So you also recently had the opportunity to drive something else.
I did. Entirely different vehicle.
Yeah.
I drove the, are we talking about the Ford Bronco Everglades? Is that where?
Unless there's something else you want to add in as well.
No, I feel like that's the one. Yeah. So they, Ford is taking the Bronco and doing all the other things it can do besides just call it a Bronco. There's the Ford Bronco two-door and four-door. There's the Ford Bronco Raptor. And there's the Ford Bronco Everglades. I'm waiting for the Ford Bronco, whatever they call the winter edition. There needs to be one super snowy.
That'll be the Yeti.
The Ford Bronco Yeti. I like it because they have the Sasquatch.
And it'll come with a Yeti cooler in the back and a full set of Yeti mugs.
It'll be the same like Sasquatch logo that's on things, but instead it'll be like a little white snowman-y Sasquatch.
Yeah, perfect. A little abominable snowman.
So what this is, the Everglades is where the Raptor is like your off-road desert racing thing. The regular Bronco gets you through kind of like everything. The Everglades is the one that you want to take if you're going to drive through serious water. Think like the Florida Everglades. They didn't take us to Florida because I'm really thinking crocodiles and they don't want us all to die. So they took us to this place called Drummond Island, which is in northern Michigan. You have to take a ferry over there, put all your cars in the ferry, you drive out there. It's like this very rustic island, and there's tons of swampy, like, mucking around in the dirt. I mean, real swamp, not like, oh, a little puddle that's 2 inches deep. No, an amount of water that made me sometimes go, I know that you can wade 36.4 inches. I feel like we're past that. Like, it was a lot of water that we were.
This is why I was joking about leeches last week.
I know. And that's all I could think of, dang you. Like, we're going to get out. And I'm like, looking at, and I, it wasn't, the spot I was at was just like muddy, but not like sink to your ankles. And I'm like, do I need the waders? I don't see leeches. Sam said there were leeches. Sam.
And I'm like, I don't know if there's actually any leeches.
Oh, I'm sure, no doubt there was, because this was like, this is muddy, mucky, brown, swampy water that they have us driving through, which it sounds like I'm saying they tortured us. They didn't. It was actually really great because
we were torturing the vehicles.
And there aren't many, you know, you can't know if this vehicle does what it says without Ford going, well, here, we will bring you to an extreme version of what this can do and let you drive it through it. And the thing was, it did. It did everything it was supposed to. We're in water. I don't know if anybody who has ever been in a small boat, like, and when the water's splashing against the bottom of the boat and you can feel it underneath you, like if you're sitting a little, and yep, you can hear it, it was just like that. But I'm like, oh my God, I'm in a car. And it's that sound and that sensation, and it's freaking me out a little bit. But we went through very long stretches of water that was, you know, 36.4 is the maximum wading depth. I feel like we were right there. They had given us waders. So if we needed to get out, we had waders to protect us from the evil leeches and whatever else was in the mucky water that was there. And there was under the wheels, you know, we drove an entire day. It wasn't like a 5 minute drive. We basically spent an entire day driving through mud and muck and rocks over rocks and along the water, because you're right along Lake Michigan, and we drove along there. It was an extensive and very tough drive. It wasn't for the faint-hearted. It was amazing. I mean, this did it. We had, you know, this comes with a winch. You have a worn winch that can handle 10,000 pounds. It's got 100 feet of synthetic cable. And Ford even worked on the winch. It's like, worn winches are already pretty amazing, but they did a few little tweaks to it because they wanted it to resist corrosion and hold up a little bit better. So it's kind of like a Ford-ized version of this winch that's better than the average. We all have these winches. It's part of the package when you get the Everglades. We didn't actually need it, except there was a tree that I'm still sort of slightly convinced that a couple of sturdy gentleman could have just pulled out of the way, but the guy's like, no, we're going to
winch it.
Yes.
A couple of sturdy gentlemen might have put it in the way.
That's a good point. This was a media program.
It's true. But there was that one, and there was another little tree later on we didn't need it. Like, there's 12 of us. We're going through this muck. Nobody is like a professional, you know, swamp driver here. None of us got stuck. None of us got stuck. We all did it. And they have
swamp driver.
Swamp driver. I know. I want to say like off-roader, but I feel like that's just generic. Swamp driver. Say swamp driver. None of us live in the Everglades. Yeah. These are for swamp drivers. If you're a swamp driver, and I got the car for you.
Well, the other reason they probably took you to Drummond Island instead of the actual Everglades is because there's also no Burmese pythons on Drummond.
You know what? I'm not listening to you with the things that are going to kill me in the water anymore, Sam. Shush.
Did you hear about the one they just caught in Florida a couple weeks ago?
I see that.
Cargo.
18 feet long, 215 pounds.
No, I don't. I feel like everything in Florida wants to kill you. It's big and scary and wants to kill you. It's like crocodiles, alligators.
And then there's the wildlife.
Yeah. Yep. Bum, bum. So the Everglades is a very purpose specific vehicle, but it's, you know, you don't have to be driving it in those circumstances. It has a snorkel on it too. So, you know, you can handle this water. If you don't really need that, much like every other off-road vehicle, you don't have to do as much off-roading as they say you can do, but you can still buy it if you want it. You know, I don't know how many people will need this kind of capability, but if you do live someplace where it's swampy, it is amazing. And to be able to get through all that water, and it truly, as you're driving along and you're looking at some of these muddy ruts that we're driving through, that's like you can just see the vehicle just sink into the mud and come right out the other side. It was cool to see. And it is kind of exciting to think that you could do that. And it did prove that, you know, they built this to be able to get through that kind of off-road terrain, and it did it no problem.
I assume you didn't go doors off that day.
No, but some guys did do roof off. Like they took the roof. And I was like, you people are nutcases. Cause you know what else swamps have? Mosquitoes the size of sparrows. I'm like, I am not.
Leeches, just flying leeches all over the place.
Yeah, I'm like,
well, the mosquitoes are carrying the leeches and dropping them. Yeah, and they drop them. With them.
See, I had my everything buttoned up nice and tight. But yeah, there was no way I was going to do that. But so there were, did anyone have doors off? I know there were some windows open and there was roofs off. I know a couple of guys that like forgot to do the sunscreen thing, and I'm like, you know, you're bald. Put that sunscreen on, good sir. And there was a couple of Ford folks. I don't know why they picked white. Why you would wear anything white? And they went.
It seems like a lot of these folks just haven't done a lot of off roading.
Well, the Ford folks have. These guys do, but
and they're all weak, and they're like, I'm gonna put some white on.
Got like mud on them, and I'm thinking, and I wore like my nastiest jeans, beat up sneakers, and clothes, and I'm like, if these have to stay in a trash can in Michigan at the end of this, I'm okay.
they need to have everybody in the communications team actually go and spend a week with Mike Levine before they do stuff like that.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think Mike Levine lives in a house. I think he lives in a Ford Bronco in the desert.
Yeah.
You don't think he
does. Well,
he goes back and forth between a Bronco and a Ranger.
Yeah, I'm out here in the nowhere land. Here's another thing.
For those that don't know Mike, he is the director of North American Product Communications for Ford.
And he is constantly sharing images online of these most amazing sunrises and sunsets and starry skies when he's out there in the middle of nowhere with whatever Ford off-road thing he's driving at any given moment. The Everglades. So it's pretty amazing.
How much is it? Oh, sorry.
I'm trying to get the starting price. I should have had that in front of me and I didn't. You know, I'm going to blame dinner because I didn't open this up until the last second. But it's like in the $55,000-ish range. Which is like a lot, but not a lot. Think about what off-road vehicle more like really like capable, not just like, you can put it in all-wheel drive and drive through that field. No, but like,
yeah, I mean, a Wrangler Rubicon or a Land Rover Defender is going to cost you at least as much. So,
right. Yeah. So it's not a crazy outrageous price. It's a price that feels fair for what you're getting. It was pretty cool. I mean, it was a unique thing, and I've done a lot of random off-road driving over the years, and this is the first time I've ever driven through anything like this, though. I've never had another OEM or another event where there was just so much mud and water and muck.
I think it's I'm hoping if you buy the Ford Bronco Everglades or any other vehicle and you're fording through water, moving water like rivers and floods and what, like, don't drive through that. Even if it's only like a foot or like 18 inches and you're like, my car, no. No, that's not the same. Completely not the same. Because, first of all, you're usually driving over concrete or asphalt, so you're going to slip. And water is very powerful. At the end of the day, water always wins.
There's a reason why the Grand Canyon exists.
Exactly.
You know, water, it's not full of water.
Wins.
You know, you do have to be careful going through water. You never, like, is even if it's standing water, like some of these spots, like these, they
know.
Scoped out this course, so they know. But then we had really torrential rains right before. So some of it wasn't quite what it was literally 24 hours before. But they're saying, you know, we know there's a rock here. We know there's a rock there. And there's things, if you just went blasting through this water that looks pretty smooth and calm and whatever, there are rocks under there that if you just hit them, you don't want to hit them like that. Like, go through with a certain amount of caution. You can't see what's down there. So pay attention to how you're driving and don't just go blazing through, even if it's, you know, standing water, not like a river, which you shouldn't be driving through anyway. You know, and I should also say they had the guys from Tread Lightly, I think it is, out there. So we were like on an area where you were allowed to drive. We weren't just randomly tearing up a natural preserve with no regard for anything. So it was very responsible off-roading before anyone, because I know especially with water, people get very concerned about that. But
take that, leeches.
Yeah, those leeches. You don't want to hurt the leeches. Oh, and also I just double check. I had 55 in my head because that was my ad. As sort of like as tested price, it starts at about 35.
Well, the Bronco starts at 35,
yeah,
but not the Everglades.
What's the Everglades start at?
The Everglades starts at 53.
Oh, does it start at 53? Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And is it four-door only for the Everglades?
Yes.
Okay. Four-door only.
You would, but I mean, is it that bad? I like the two-door Bronco.
I don't want people in my car.
Well, you don't have to bring people in your car. You can leave people behind.
I guess it's easy to get the dogs in and out. All right, I get this one. Yeah.
Especially with the muck. Imagine they've mucked around in that water.
Mucked around.
They're going to leap over the driver's seat to get into the back seat. You don't want
that. Yeah. And, well, I put a little staircase in the back and they just do, 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 do.
I'm glad you have a plan for the dogs.
And back to your point about, you know, being careful going through the water. The other thing the other reason you don't want to go through water really fast is because there might be something sharp down there that's going to cut your tire.
Yeah.
And the last thing you want to be doing is be stuck in the middle of a river with a flat tire.
Fortunately you have the winch, so you can just drag your car out and then change the flat tire.
Yeah.
If you haven't driven in water, like even if you get the Bronco Everglades, I don't recommend you immediately find 36.4 inches of water to wade through.
You want to build up to it.
Yeah.
Build up to it. Take a class. There's probably a class.
Just because you can doesn't mean you should. Like, figure out how to work your way up. Because if you just start driving through that kind of water, you're suddenly going to be in 4.5 feet of water and be like, whoops, and you're going to be in trouble. So don't, you know, yeah, you can do this, but make sure you know how to do this before you do that kind of aggressive driving through water.
Baby steps.
Baby steps.
Yep. We all did baby steps. We all learned, like, you know, driving quickly, driving, you know.
Yeah.
We all learned that by driving slowly first.
Exactly. So be responsible when you're driving this thing. Don't be a lunatic.
That's right. Well, you should be that all the time.
Make sure to put it on YouTube so we can all point and laugh.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right. Let's stick with Ford for a minute. There was some news that came out of Ford this week that going forward, they are changing the terms on new leases for customers that are getting electric vehicles. Traditionally, you know, when you lease a vehicle in the contract, they give you at the end of the lease term, they give you a price that, you know, if you want to keep that vehicle, you know, here's the price you're going to pay for it if you want to buy it and just keep it forever. I've only ever leased a vehicle one time, and we did end up buying it at the end of the lease and keeping it. But going forward for Ford electric vehicles, you will no longer have that option. You're going to have to give the EV back to Ford at the end of the lease. If you want to keep it, you got to just buy it outright at the beginning. You can't do a lease and then buy it.
Is that just people who are buying EVs from, like, here on out? Like, if you have one,
yeah,
buy
it. if you're currently already leasing a Lightning or a Mach-E, you're fine. You still have that option in your contract. But from now on, you can't buy it at the end of the lease. It's going back to Ford, and they'll decide where they want to put it. What do you think about this?
I'm confused at the, like, well, it's because of batteries. I'm like, what do you mean? Because at least, like, even a high-end, you know, at least with 15,000 miles, you get a three-year lease. That's only 45,000 miles on the vehicle, unless you, like, you know, drive it. But even then, the battery should be fine.
I don't think that's
5%. I'm confused at the battery.
I don't think that's the real reason. I think what it is, they want to have more control over the resale value of these vehicles, because traditionally most EVs have experienced a lot more depreciation over the first several years, because there was uncertainty among customers about, you know, what the condition of the battery is and all this stuff. And also because of the tax incentives, the $7,500 tax break, that was generally factored in to the resale value. So, you know, if you bought a $47,500 EV and you got that $7,500 off, they figured the depreciation based on that $40,000 net value, net price, rather than the actual sticker price. And mm-hmm. So you had the same amount of depreciation, but it was starting from a lower point. So your overall depreciation was greater. And I think, you know, what Ford wants to do, and Tesla has done the same thing. They, you know, in Tesla leases, you don't have the option to buy it most of the time. There have been some leases where they've done that, but most Tesla leases, you don't get the option to buy it at the end of the lease. You have to turn it back into Tesla. What Tesla has done is they have controlled the flow of used off-lease Teslas back into the used car market to try to keep the prices up and keep the prices high, rather than just flooding the market with all these off-lease cars, which is one of the problems that other automakers have traditionally had in the past is
i3.
Flooding the market with off-lease cars. That's also one of the reasons why companies like BMW originally started doing certified pre-owned programs. So, you know, that basically what they were doing was taking trade-ins, but mostly off-lease BMWs, because BMW leases most of their vehicles. Most BMW customers don't buy, they lease. And so they were taking those, you know, cleaning them up, refurbing them, and then reselling them with a warranty. And I'm sure that's what Ford's going to be doing with these. You know, they'll parcel them out and, you know, do a CPO type program, and also make sure their dealers have some inventory of used EVs to sell. I
don't know why they said batteries, but whatever.
Well, you know, I think that's what was speculated in some other reports, but I don't think that's entirely the situation. Also with EVs, yesterday, as we record this, we're recording this a little early this week because of the upcoming long weekend, Hyundai released photos of the IONIQ 6, their next EV that's coming out later this year. I think the full reveal is in mid-July, if I recall. But what do you think about the IONIQ 6?
It looks good. I like it.
Someone said it looks like a Pokemon. I forget who. Someone on the internet said the front looks like a Pokemon. And I'm like, oh, it does look like a Pokemon.
Now I'm going to call it. Why does it look Pokemon? Like a Pokemon? I don't
see a Pokemon. The front does look like a Pokemon.
Well, if it was bright yellow or something, it could be a Pikachu. But I feel like, generally speaking,
there's a lot of Pokemon out there.
How does it look like?
You got to catch them all, Nicole.
which Pokemon are we talking about, Robbie?
I think it's just Pokemon in general.
Is it because it looks
like
cute?
If there was a Pokemon car, it would be the IONIQ 6.
I'm trying to just look at, like, the headlights and I guess it kind of has a Pokemon vibe. It's cute. But then you take your hand away and you look at the whole thing and you're like, ooh, sexy little car.
Pika Pika.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's got a bit of Mercedes CLS there with the slope in the back.
Yeah.
And you know, you look at it in profile and you see the side glass, you know, kind of curves down a little bit towards the back end. And then the interior, you know, the photos they showed are with the optional camera mirror system. So there's no outside mirrors. There's just a couple of little cameras on stocks that stick out at the base of the A-pillar. And then the dashboard curves up at either end, and there's a display there for that shows what the cameras are seeing. So instead of outside mirrors, you get the that interior display. But yeah, no technical details on this, although, you know, other than it's on the same EGMP platform as the IONIQ 5 and the Kia EV6 and other upcoming models. I think there's some speculation somewhere that the range, you know, would be over 300 miles, which seems reasonable since this thing has a very low coefficient of drag. I think it's only 0.21, so it's very slippery. But it doesn't look like the IONIQ 5, which I thought was interesting. They've got it, but it's still got a little bit of the pixel thing in the driving lamps in the headlamp clusters. It's got the pixel lights there, but overall, it doesn't have that kind of squared off shape of the IONIQ 5. It's a sleeker shape.
I think it's cool that they didn't just try to continue to make it look the same. You know, that it's like they don't all need to look the same. Like it's a different look. I didn't want it to just be iterations of the IONIQ 5, and it's you know. I like it.
Gotta get small.
It's good to see that they're at least going to do at least one electric sedan.
Yeah, you know, they Hyundai and Kia, they're like sticking with the sedans. They're like, you know what, everyone else is like exiting this space. That means that those people won't sell cars, and people who want sedans will buy ours.
Yeah.
They said,
okay.
And you're saying that like people don't, you know, drive them anymore. Yeah, but they might not drive them as much, but there's still a heck of a lot of sedans out there. Mm-hmm. You know?
I'm still buying them. Not as much as the, you know, teeny tiny SUVs, but... Well, teeny tiny is like, that's not even true.
Exactly. I mean, you know, they still sell, you know, 250,000 Camrys and Accords each a year, and I think a similar number of Altimas. So, you know, there's still a market there. It's not as big as it was 10 years ago, but it's still there.
It's not like
100,000, so many cars.
Yeah. All right. Another EV-related story. This one last weekend was the 100th running of the Pikes Peak Hill Climb in Colorado. And in this one, there were a couple of drivers, including Randy Popst? I can't remember. I'm not sure how it's pronounced. Driving Tesla Model S Plaids. And the touchscreen in there almost killed the two drivers because there was fog, and partway up the hill, they got into the fog, and their windshields fogged up immediately. And because there was no button there that you hit that turns on the defroster, they were, you know, while they were racing up the hill at over 100 miles an hour, they were trying to find the defogger control in the touchscreen menus. So this is an example of why touchscreens do not belong in cars that you have to drive.
You need buttons.
Yeah.
I every time someone like leaves buttons in cars, I'm like, oh, thank you. And I think more and more automakers are like, you know what? I think we've gone a little too far with this. There's a place for touchscreen, but there's also a place for buttons. And we got to put some buttons in here because people like buttons. And apparently it makes it safer when you're flying up Pikes Peak at 100 and whatever miles an hour.
Although I do ever so slightly, not in defense of how it was, because I get it. It should have been easier to reach, but I feel like if I'm going to race a car like you do up Pikes, would you not find some of that stuff ahead of time?
What was that?
Would you find some of that
know where the
time? Maybe locate things that might be important. Like, no, maybe make sure you could get to that pretty quick if you had to get
like,
to
it. Like, oh, we're going up in a mountain. It's going to get cold.
Maybe we should
know how the defroster works. Or just turn it on beforehand.
Yeah, I feel like I'm not like removing fault from Tesla or removing responsibility, but like also.
Also, as a car driver, as a race car driver, you should know about the second part of that is car.
Yeah.
Car part. The driver part? Cool. The car part. I feel like maybe I should have looked.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then the final story I've got for this week is TFL Truck. Those guys do some great work. They're out in Colorado, and they do a lot of interesting tests, especially, you know, if you're into towing and stuff like that. And they've done one of the interesting tests they do is their Ike Gauntlet. They go up to the Eisenhower Tunnel, and they drive with a truck with a trailer, and they drive down, and it's like several thousand feet descent. It's a pretty steep grade too.
It is.
And then they turn around and go back up. And you know, normally, you know, with a gas or diesel truck, you know, you're using the tow haul mode, and one of the things they do when they're doing that test is they count how many times you have to tap on the brake during the course of the descent, you know, for it to maintain its speed. Last week they did their Ike test with the Rivian R1T and with the Lightning, and going down the hill, the Lightning, they touched the brake one time at the top and then didn't have to touch it again because the regenerative braking was able to get enough deceleration to have a constant speed all the way down the hill, and it worked great. And then going back up, no problem at all towing. They were towing an 8,000-pound trailer back up the mountain. Had no problem at all doing it. Never overheated the battery or the motor. This time, just today or yesterday, they released a new video where they did a test where they compared the Lightning against the GMC Sierra Denali Ultimate with a 6,000-pound trailer on the back.
Oh, geez.
And wanted to see how far could they go on one charge or one tank of gas. The Lightning didn't do so well. with a full charge, by the time they got to 85 miles, it was down to 9%.
Oh.
Yeah.
Time to find some charging.
Yay. Yep. And so they had to abort the test and actually go back, turn around and go back, because the nearest charging station, DC fast charging station ahead of them, was 40 miles down the road, and they only had 20 miles of range. And then there was one about 3 or 4 miles back behind them. This is, you know, I mean, it wasn't level ground. They were going up a slight grade, but still, you know, 85 miles going from 100% to 9% charge was not very confidence inspiring.
Wow.
Especially since, you know, when they started off, that one thing they didn't actually do in the test is, and one of the things that in the interview I did with Darren Palmer when we did the first drive, he talked about they have the calibration mode. So when you hook up a trailer for the first time, you can go in there, you can give it, you know, information about the weight and the height and width and length of the trailer. There's also a calibration mode where you can go and just drive it for 10 miles, and you know, it measures actually how much energy it's using to drive that with that particular trailer. And it uses that to try to give you a more accurate range estimate. And you know, when they started off, the range estimate was 155 miles, but they only managed to go a little over about 85 miles. And I think part of it is because they didn't do the calibration. So they could have known up front that they weren't going to be able to make it as far as they wanted to go. But still, 85 miles, not very good. It's 0.7 miles per kilowatt hour is what they got.
Whoo. Yeah. If you got I think if you have a trailer because you go to the lake or you got a boat or whatever, you're still probably just going to need a big truck. And even then, I still think people, like, if you have a big truck just for that, that seems like a lot of money when you could just rent a big truck whenever you
want. Yeah, well, I mean, if you're using it every weekend.
Yeah, if you're using it every weekend. Yeah. But I think I've seen a lot of boats that just sit there for, like, months on end. And you're like,
that's because you don't have any water in California.
That's true.
We have lots of lakes here.
We have water, too. We also have lakes. Not great, but we have lakes.
Next time I'm there, I steal some of your water, bring it back with me.
Just pick some back, so then you guys.
I think like motorcycles and stuff. I fear some of those, like, that's their thing. You do every weekend, awesome, go for it. But if you're also the person who's you got the jet skis or the motorcycles and you never ride them, but you got the big truck for them. That's a lot of money.
Yep.
It's a lot of money.
Especially
don't
if you
don't get an EV unless you're going, they're pretty close.
Yeah. I mean, around here, you know, I mean, there's a lot of lakes within a 30-mile radius of where I'm sitting right now. So, I mean, for me, you know, I could easily use a Lightning, you know, and towing, you know, a couple of jet skis or in the wintertime, a couple of snowmobiles, you know, 30, 40 miles, not a problem. But, yeah, you definitely, this is definitely something you need to consider. And, it, you know, as I said, when we talked about it before, you know, this is the one thing that the Lightning doesn't do better than the gas F-150 is long distance towing. Short distances, no problem at all. But long distances, and you know, this was a tall, wide, tall trailer, you know, so it wasn't particularly aerodynamic, but it's still tough.
Yeah.
Dead right. The brakes.
Yep.
I don't know what that means.
let's answer a few listener questions. Starting off with Chintan Kamen, I think is how you pronounce that, from Twitter. He says, my kid is profoundly red-green colorblind. And we were talking about colorblindness.
Oh, we were talking about
last week or the week before. It's not that he can't see those colors or that he can't see other colors. It's that those colors look like a muddled, murky brown, and he can't discern between red and green. Good news. He gets his license in 2 years.
Oh, well, I mean, but that's also why when you come to traffic lights, they're all, like, universally, it's always red on top, yellow, and then green at the bottom.
So then when you have a car and it turns green for normal mode in your car and red for, he just sees murky brown and murky brown.
Yeah. Okay.
That was a good show.
Super Cruise would not be great.
I thought the same thing when I said that, Murky Brown.
Remember Murky Brown? That one time, they had Paul Rubens. He was their secretary once.
At least now we know what happens.
All right. Fozzie B says, curious, is anyone on the Wheel Bearings team scheduled to drive the Fisker Ocean? If not, curious what the general sentiment of the team is regarding Fisker's go-to-market strategy with Magna Steyr. So it's still a little early. The Ocean's not coming out till the end of the year. They haven't given any invites to anybody to drive it yet. So probably, you know, in the November, December timeframe.
I would think late this year or early next, depending on how production goes.
Everything going on.
Yeah.
But what do you think about their overall strategy?
Using Magna
to manufacture the vehicle.
Oh God, that's a genius!
Yeah.
That's a genius because they build the Supra, the G-Wagon, some other cars.
They build a lot of vehicles for a lot of manufacturers.
Yeah, people don't realize that Magna builds a lot of cars for a lot of manufacturers.
It's a great idea to get somebody who knows how to build cars the first time you try.
Granted, this is the second time that Henrik has tried.
That's true.
It's splitting hairs, whatever.
And the first time didn't work out so well. So this time he got a better partner.
What were they using before?
Valmet. But, you know, also last time around, they tried to do more of the engineering in-house, and they didn't really have the resources to
do it.
Engineer the Karma fully. So it was kind of half-assed, to say the least. And, you know, so this time around, you know, Magna is doing a lot of the vehicle engineering. And so I think things will work out a lot better for them.
Cool.
And then this is from some guy named Sam, responding to a tweet that you had, Roberto. But tell us about the time you were allowed to drive a tractor on regular roads before you got your license.
So when I was a young child in my teens, I got a job with the school. If you were poor, you could get a job with the school during the summer. That's all you had to be. It was poor and like you'd show up. I thought I would like done all this stuff to get this job. But it turns out you just had to be poor. And so I got a job at the school farm, which is how I ended up in FFA. So at the farm, I was 13 when I started, and when I drove the tractor, I was probably about 14 or 15. So I'd worked at that farm for a few summers, and one day they're like, "Hey, we need to."
So what they do is in California, they use poor children as farm laborers.
Yes.
As underage farm laborer.
At school. Or I could have been a janitor, or I could have worked at the bus barn. The bus barn is where all the mechanics were, and that's where the tractor was. And it was probably about, I don't know, maybe 2 or 3 miles away. It's a small town, so it wasn't really that far away. So my boss, who is a teacher, took me over there to pick up the little John Deere tractor. And I had driven it before in class because, you know, there was no labor laws that I couldn't drive. And he was just like, oh, we got to get this back. And he just kind of looked around and was like, well, do you want to drive it back? And I'm like, oh, because I wasn't allowed to use any, like, I wasn't allowed to use the weed whacker or the lawnmower. It's like all these rules.
But when you're a big giant tractor.
No problem.
Yeah, but it was like, well, you know how to drive it. It's only down the street. It'll be fine. So he gave me the – so he's like, go for it. And so I got to drive the tractor down through Tehachapi as a 15-year-old without a license, and it was the greatest thing ever. I was like, yeah. He's like, do not engage anything. I'm like, I know, I know. I don't know why it was – it felt awesome. It was like the
– you know,
and to be honest, I had been driving cars way before I had a license. I kind of got in trouble at some point because of that. But I was driving cars before I had a license. But for some reason, driving the tractor just felt way cooler. Doing okay, like 5 miles an hour through town with a tractor. Just like, hey,
how you doing? Side note, today, for the first time ever, I live out, there's a lot of farms and stuff where I live, and I was just out driving with my daughter, and there, apparently it's the time of year when you cut all the grass and you turn it into hay bales, and I've never seen this before, and I, for the first time, saw a little machine just drive along the cut hay, and then it, like, little thing goes up and down, and then all of a sudden, foot, a bale of hay goes shooting out of the back of it. And
yeah.
I was like, that might be the cool. And I was like, I literally stopped the car. I'm like, check this out. We're like, oh my God, that is the, I want to drive whatever.
The rectangular bales or the big round ones?
These are rectangular bales. And they literally, it's like the machine drives along and you see contraptions moving from the road. Things are moving. And all of a sudden, like, food, it goes shooting into the air, into the thing in the back. I'm like, I want to drive that. I don't even know what that's called. Is it a hay baler, I guess? That,
probably.
I want to drive that thing. I just want little hay bales to go, food.
And it's super impressive because when you have the hay, when you snip it open, it doesn't just fall into little sections. So you go, oh, here's a flake of hay for this horse, here's a flake of hay for this horse. Yeah, those machines are
Never watched it. I was like, I mean, literally there's a farm I could walk to 5 feet out my door practically. I'm like, how have I never seen this process before? It's the coolest thing I saw all day.
Yeah, driving tractor is fun. It's, you know, you don't have like an accelerator. You have you do have an accelerator, but it's like a lever and you have to be careful. That's why there's always, if you ever look at a tractor, there's all those weights on the front. Like on the front, there's usually like these big, like metal, like, mm-hmm. like those are weights, so you don't do wheelies.
Oh, because you got so much torque, and
you have so much torque in the back, and it's, you know, it's built so we can, like, you know, you're attaching things to it, it's dragging.
You got a really low gear ratio.
Yeah,
you
know, it's super low. Yeah. So if you're not careful, you'll flip it over. Yeah, so that's why all those weights are up in the front.
Okay.
The more you learn.
The more you learn. Know. Ding 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 ding.
Yeah, the more you know. Ding. Okay, sorry.
Next up, M. Burns asks, Jeep question number one. With the new Grand Cherokee, will Jeep offer the eco-diesel engine as an option at some point?
I don't know. Is diesel even a thing people want to do anymore?
Yeah, that. I don't know.
I doubt it.
I would guess no.
I'd say the chances are somewhere between slim and none.
Yeah, I don't see that happening.
Especially, you know, now that they're electrifying, you know, so you've already got the plug-in hybrid and the regular Grand Cherokee. They're almost certainly going to add that to the Grand Cherokee L at some point. Mm-hmm. It's going to be in the Wagoneer. Then there's battery electric versions coming in a couple of years.
Yeah,
I would not expect it to ever see another Jeep diesel. And
it could
not
surprise us, but it just doesn't. It's not, it would seem like an odd direction given what the direction of things in general is going, and especially with what Jeep has said that they're doing.
And Stellantis also just settled a similar Dieselgate case to what Volkswagen had couple of months ago. They paid, like, I think almost $1 billion fine.
Wow.
For cheating on diesel emissions.
$1 billion.
Yeah. If you're looking for something for hardcore towing, just go back to towing. Jeep has Dodge. I mean, Stellantis has Dodge. You know,
the Dodge Ram. Well, and, you know, the
not Dodge or Dodge Ram, it's just Ram.
you know, the Wagoneer, you know, with the new Hurricane six-cylinder, it'll tow 10,000 pounds. You know, I'm sure it's only a matter of time before the Hurricane goes into the Grand Cherokee as well, as an option in there. And, you know, it'll probably have similar towing capability. So, yeah. And then if you need, you know, more than 10,000 pounds, you know, just get a Ram.
Yep.
Get a semi.
Okay. Jeep question number two. Nicole, you speak highly of your family's Jeep Wrangler Unlimited 4xe. If you had to buy a new Jeep Wrangler Unlimited, would you consider the EcoDiesel over the 4xe if cost and or availability of the latter were an issue?
I wouldn't go for an EcoDiesel because because the whole reason that we got the plug-in, the 4xe, was because the niftiness of being able to drive in the quiet off-road, and the EcoDiesel does not provide that. So the reasons we went with that, other powertrains don't work. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's not that I wouldn't do an EcoDiesel. It's just that for me wouldn't have worked. What sold us on getting the one that we got was when I honestly at the drive program, when I went and I'm like, this is amazing. Just driving out there in this somewhere in Texas and you're driving through this field and you can just hear the grass crunching under the tires and you can hear birds chirping and you can hear crickets.
Your skid plates scraping over the rocks.
You can hear skid plates scraping over the rocks. So it sounds really hokey. It's like, it's not like I'm like Mother Earth woman over here, but it was nice to be able to hear the world around you and hear the nature around you. And you can save that EV mode until you're off-roading in the 4xe. That's what made us do it. The diesel is not going to do that. So,
and it sounds like a tractor.
It sounds it's the exact opposite, I think. So I would not. If you were just looking for, I don't know, fuel economy, is that more what he's asking? Then
if you're doing small trips all week, I mean, I wish one of our cars was a PHEV, one of our gas cars was a PHEV, because I've just been doing small trips when my wife takes the car to work, the electric car. So I have the BRZ and the Jaguar. The Jaguar has a V6. The BRZ has a 4-cylinder. And I've been driving a BRZ a little bit more, and then I had to go put $60 in gas in it a little bit ago, a few hours ago, because it was on E, and the light was on, and it was hitting the little red thing.
I must do it.
And while I'm filling it up with gas, I'm like, you know, I love this car, but I wish I had another car that was either a PHEV or an EV. Just
like, I would wait. If availability of the 4xe is an issue, and I know that it is, availability of everything is an issue. If I could wait, I would just wait. I'm like, well, not getting a new car this week. I'm getting a new car whenever. Yeah. If you're looking, like, Jeep says it's going to be another month. Okay, it's another month. Jeep says it's another month. It's really another three. Okay, it's another three. Like, I like the 4xe enough that I would wait for it unless I had to buy something else because my other car went.
Okay. And then final question from Mr. Burns. also a diesel question. In general, are diesel ICEs, it's internal combustion engines, a bad investment right now? If you can't afford to get into a PHEV or a BEV, is there longevity at all in, say, the Ram, Jeep, EcoDiesel, ICE models? So the Jeeps, yeah, do they even still offer the diesel in the Wrangler? I can't remember.
I'm not sure. Blank.
Okay, I know.
Speak amongst yourselves.
They do, it's the only one.
You do the Googling, Robbie.
Yeah. if they do, the Wrangler is the only one that still offers a diesel. None of the others currently do. And then there is the Ram. And, you know, I think the answer depends a lot. You know, if you're going to do a lot of long distance towing, then a diesel is actually probably your best option, because that is kind of the ideal use case for a diesel. You know, under load, relatively constant speed, those things just, they rock. You know, you're gonna, with a gas engine, you know, going back to the TFL video, you know, the Denali that they were driving with the 6.2 liter V8, that thing only got 7 miles per gallon towing that trailer.
Oh my God!
So, you know, it didn't actually do a whole lot better than the EV. Wow. But with a diesel, if you had that truck with GM's 3-liter inline six diesel pulling that same trailer, you probably could have got close to 20 miles per gallon. And the same thing is true with the Ram. So if you actually do a lot of long distance towing, the diesel is actually your best option. Anything else, I would probably not go for the diesel at this point.
Yeah, I don't think I would. I don't even necessarily think it's like, is it a bad investment? I just don't see. I just would, unless I'm towing, I wouldn't do it. Unless I'm towing, I wouldn't do it.
I mean, they're more expensive. The fuel is typically more expensive, at least here in the U.S. And I mean, I'm a fan of diesels. I like diesel engines. You know, we used to own a Jetta diesel until we had to sell it back to Volkswagen. But you know, so I do like diesels. I like the torque that they make, and you know, and in a lot of cases, I like the sound that they make. Like I like the, especially the GM diesel. The Stellantis Eco Diesel is not quite that refined, but the GM diesel is a fantastic engine. Mm-hmm. And you know, if you were going to get an internal combustion light duty truck or SUV from GM, I would seriously consider that one. Like I say, especially if you're going to do any towing or you know regularly hauling heavy payloads, that's where that engine rocks. Because I mean, I had an Escalade with that diesel in it last year, and got 23 miles per gallon with it. And you know, I've had the Ram diesel before and gotten 23 miles per gallon with 1,000 pounds of fencing material in the bed.
No mulch.
No mulch that trip.
Oh. Mulch isn't even heavy enough. The diesel just laughs at it.
That was just building a fence for somebody around their yard. So. You know, for those kinds of use cases, diesel's great. Everything else at this point, you're pretty much better going either plug-in hybrid or battery electric.
Yeah, so you can get a 3-liter V6 turbo diesel engine with the on the Wrangler. It's $3,500 more.
Okay.
So it's more expensive.
Yeah, I mean on the GM full-size SUVs like the Escalade and I think the Tahoe, the diesel is actually the same price as the 6.2-liter V8. So you can, if you get an Escalade, you can pick either one for the same price.
Mm-hmm.
Escalade.
Not the Escalative, just the regular Escalade.
Not the Escalade.
Yeah. All right. I think the only other thing we've got for this week is I've finally got the interview I did with Jack Hollis during Toyota Palooza. Jack Hollis is now the senior vice president of the automotive operations group at Toyota. The week after we were there, he got promoted. I can't remember what his old title was when I talked to him, but he's basically in charge of all the automotive stuff at Toyota North America now. And so we talked about EVs and hybrids and Toyota and so on. So I'll drop that in here and we'll say goodbye and talk to you next time.
See ya.
Have a nice fourth. Do some
Bye.
Barbecuing or whatever you people do. Bye.
It's been a busy week for everybody, I'm sure.
Yes, sir.
You guys have announced a lot of things this week. We've seen and driven a number of different things. One area I'd like to start with is, kind of this transition that is happening in the industry right now and how Toyota, is looking at it. You know, we've got this shift towards more electrification, connectivity, more advanced ADAS systems, automation. How is Toyota going to handle this transition? How do you see it impacting the kinds of products you do and how you deal with customers, especially around education around these technologies?
Okay, you got a little. There's a couple of things that I can go with, and I want to make sure that I answer. So I'll go one way, and then you can.
Okay.
Let me know if I've
kind of an open-ended question.
What it is, and I want to make sure I hit the core because I think that it's really critical to understand what we're looking at as a company because it's battery electric that we're bringing as a company. We've seen a lot. It's not exclusive to Lexus or Toyota, right? It's across both. But the way the taste of each of our brands is going to handle some of these things slightly differently, right? Where like we do on every other product.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at, there tends to be a bit of a difference. At the luxury side, the Lexus side, you have a lot of consumers who are going and getting a lot of education around the entire EV infrastructure, or I'm sorry, EV ecosystem. What we have found is you find some of the more luxury buyers, they're installing chargers in their homes prior to purchasing a vehicle. Uh-huh. They're going and getting educated with a private, you know, electrician, and they're setting up their house, and people who are building new homes at a luxury level. I'm here in Texas, next door neighbor. They're building it with one neighbor directly next to me is building it with a fast charger in his house. I don't know why he needs a fast charger.
A DC fast charger?
Yeah. But so why does he need that? But he is committed to that, right? That's a luxury buyer. He already has two luxury vehicles in the home, one being electric, one not. But so I want us to separate these. Mm-hmm. So there's an education level, though, that has to be across the entire EV ecosystem, both the Toyota Lexus and the industry. Mm-hmm. Okay, so with that said, we're putting forth a lot of efforts with our dealers to make sure that we are first starting by the educating of our dealers, mm-hmm. of all of the elements for them to start to consider. And at the exact same time, we're encouraging our dealers to look at themselves not as a EV product seller, not just an EV vehicle sales, seller, but an EV ecosystem concierge. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that's a good way, a good perspective on it, I think, is an EV system concierge, or ecosystem concierge.
Okay, so since we're doing that, I need you to understand is that your question is, what are we doing specifically? Well, I can't really call it each one of those, but we're going beyond what the normal is, which is product knowledge or EV charging. That's the basics. We're talking about everything from home charging versus public charging, education on your vehicle, and what does that mean? You know, tire wear. Tire wear right now, industry-wise, is somewhere about twice as fast as normal tire wear. If you look at the companies out there. Well, what does that mean for you, Mr. Customer? So there's elements like those that were there. So to answer your question of where we're going, is we are going to see what is the maximum amount of education we can provide. But we can't just look at it as just for our own brand. We have to look at the EV ecosystem, because we want customers to experience the joy of an EV vehicle. And to do so means you have to do more than give them just product knowledge.
Right. Okay.
You gave me an open-ended question. I gave you an open-ended answer.
No, that's great.
A longer answer.
No, that's great. You know, because I think that idea of educating people around the ecosystem, because the ecosystem is, it's not just the vehicles that are changing. It's the whole ecosystem, charging versus fueling, how you service and maintain these vehicles over their lifespan.
How much time does it take to charge the vehicle?
What kind of planning do you have to do for a trip?
What kind of planning do you have to do for a trip? There's so many different elements here. But where you talk about us showing, and one of the things we tried to share, I think, this week that I think we've done a really good job, I really think is that that's just on EV because it's the quote-unquote newest right now.
Right.
That same education and planning is also around things like, how does the hybrid system work? How does the plug-in hybrid system different? How it's different? How is that different from EV? And how is that different from fuel cell, the hydrogen fuel cell technology? Because all four of those have distinct educational needs and consumer feedback based upon their own. They need to make a decision of what vehicles best fits their driving and their ultimate needs. So the education is going. The education piece, I love the word. I appreciate that. The education and training right now is one of our probably most critical focuses right now.
Okay.
Both for internally for the dealerships, us with the dealerships and the consumer. There's two pieces, right? Two streams of work.
Right.
And they're both really hot right now.
And since the dealer is the interface with the consumer, you know, it seems like it's particularly important to make sure they understand.
Absolutely.
So that they can transmit the messages back both directions, both from
the company to the consumer, and from the consumers to provide the feedback to you guys.
Which, and listen, I'm going to go every single time you give me a chance like that. I'm going to tell you why I expect and why I know that Toyota and Lexus will be successful in this. And that's because when you continue to look at the relationships that we have with our dealers, as rated by NADA being number one and number two for, you know, double-digit years, the relationship we have with our dealers is a both-way situation. Us helping them to be best for the customer, and then the customer through them helping us be the best we can backwards. It means back and forth. Mm-hmm. That's why I'm so confident in whatever ways we go, we're going to be effective, because that relationship is solid. That communication is solid, but it's the overall relationship with us, with our dealers and the consumers, that has the right balance.
Yeah, and you know, over the past year in particular, you know, there's been a lot of discussion, you know, that around the whole idea of, you know, trying to achieve carbon neutrality, and what are, you know, there's no silver bullet solution to getting there, you know, which is why, you know, you're still very much committed to hybrids and fuel cells, you know, finding the best tool for the job, and whatever that job is. And not every driver has the same job,
right,
and they don't need the same tools.
Your needs, where do you live?
Just outside of Ann Arbor.
Okay. The needs of a person living in Detroit Metro, Chicago, LA, New York, Houston, are significantly different than if you're living in Colorado Springs or Tulsa, Oklahoma, or Charleston, West Virginia, or, right? You have different needs. The city life of driving, where your round trip to work, that might be 25 miles, and your round trip in larger cities is 50 miles. I mean, there's a significantly different need on your product.
Uh-huh.
And like you said earlier, but you want to plan a trip to go see grandma, you know, that trip of 500 miles to 900 miles or 1,000 miles, that changes everything.
Yeah.
So what is it your needs? And I think what specific is, if we play this out the way it's always been done in America, is if you let the consumer decide between multiple choices that benefits carbon neutrality, you will get to carbon neutrality a lot faster than trying to push them only into one powertrain. Because the consumer still should have the choice and should make that best, what's best for them, while still reducing carbon.
I have, you know, with dealers, certainly, you know, we've seen in certain parts of the country, EVs have had a much higher rate of adoption than other parts.
Sure.
California,
absolutely,
you know, is the main one, but yeah, even here in Texas, there's a pretty strong rate of adoption, and a lot of southern states. Do you ever foresee a time when you might start to have, even though you're maintaining this diversity of powertrains, mm-hmm. where you might start to see some of your dealers start to specialize in one area or another? I know, you know, we've heard that from Ford, you know, around their reorganization into Ford Blue and Model E. Where they want to have some dealers that are focused on EVs, in your case, it could be hybrids or ICE vehicles for certain markets. Do you see that as something that would, for Toyota at least, for Toyota and Lexus, that would ever be potentially desirable or useful?
That's a fantastic question, and it's a different way of looking at it than I've heard before. It's clear that California's adoption is and always has been on newer technology, they've been early adopters. So when I see through a lens of a California dealer, I see them adopting earlier. Are you asking me between, I want to make sure I understand what you're specifically asking. Are you talking about, do you think there'd be a specialized difference between one dealer in LA and another dealer in LA?
Yeah. Do you foresee a time when there might be some Toyota dealers in LA or, you know, anywhere else that sell only EVs while others sell the full lineup?
No, I do not see that.
Okay.
I do not see that. And that's why I want to make sure I was clear with your question.
Yeah.
I don't really see that. I see that there are areas of the country which will have higher, like we do today. Mm-hmm. In Texas, you see a higher percentage of trucks being sold. When I go to Florida, you got a higher level of Camrys being sold. If I go to New York, I got Corollas being sold. If I go to different places, mm-hmm. in Colorado, it's a mix. And, okay, so when I see that, I see the difference. There's different models.
Mm-hmm.
But based on powertrain, do I see somebody being exclusive on this or that? No, I don't. I see that the full lineup across both in the state and then through the country.
Okay. one of the things we've seen, I spoke with Andrew Gilliland earlier about
this.
Okay. Especially over the past year with the supply constraints, some other manufacturers have seen a marked shift to consumers, from the traditional approach in the U.S. market of buying vehicles out of dealer inventory to ordering vehicles. Is that something that you see, that you're seeing at all for Toyota? I know for Lexus, I guess it's mostly just been ordering from what's incoming. And Toyota and Lexus, both traditionally had fewer buildable combinations of vehicles. But are you seeing any kind of shift towards, consumers ordering a specific vehicle that they want?
First, I'd say that we're seeing the same evidence in both Toyota and Lexus.
Okay.
We're not seeing any differences. And right now that's because I think there's still such a large gap between the supply and the demand. Mm-hmm. With the supply, with the demand being so high still, we don't see a big difference.
Okay.
Two is, I think that the idea of taking an order or a vehicle ordering, to be specific, it's more like reserving, right, versus an order. I want to make sure we're clear. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of consumers who are ordering, I want this car this way, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Mm-hmm. No, it's, here are the vehicles we have coming in, and a consumer saying, I would like to reserve one of those.
Yeah.
Just want to make sure we're defining things a little differently. And in that, we are seeing the dealer model really being able to spend a lot of time with that customer. So it's funny, some people think it's less touch. It's actually more touch, because with a vehicle coming in, the consumer is saying, I want to raise my hand for that vehicle. They want to make sure they're raising their hand for exactly what they want. Uh-huh. So they're spending a little bit more, there's a little bit more of a personal touch. So what we're seeing is a little bit more time taken, right, to find that vehicle. We're also seeing very few people who reserve it and then walk away. Those reservations are happening. They're landing. They're staying there, and they're committed. And so we're seeing that as a trend across both Toyota and Lexus, of a lot more, if you want to say, satisfaction with their purchase process, because taking the time. Third is, while we will definitely plan to keep our inventory at a lower level than we have had previously. You've heard that in different numbers. I don't really want to get into the exact number of inventory. I can simply tell you that we, in conjunction with our dealer council, both at Lexus and at Toyota, we will maintain a shorter amount of ground stock inventory, but allowing a lot of this reservation. And then, are you familiar with both of our Smart Path for Toyota and Monogram programs?
No, not so
much. It's our online, our digital solution.
Yeah.
And both of those, so let's take Smart Path for Toyota. It was developed by a group of dealers, four dealers, right? They helped us to develop the system. That system, where really you can go on shop, build, order, deliver, purchase, everything online, right? That becomes more of a model that dealers are going to be wanting to use, allowing that customer a lot more of the control and the flexibility in that buying process. Mm-hmm. So I do see that growing.
As part of that, do you see the dealers being involved in, if the customer is doing their order online, configuring their vehicle online, do you see the dealers perhaps participating in that maybe through a chat or some mechanism to help guide them to figure out what they want
all the time? And our system that we created it's a direct sales, but through the dealer.
Okay.
So the dealer is allowing, the dealer is can activate at any moment. You can chat, call, come in. You could actually say, you could shop and configure, come into the dealership, and the dealer could pull it up because it's saved right there. The dealer, let's look at it together. So it's a lot of touch from the dealer.
Shift to connected services.
Okay.
Several years ago, Toyota moved to an in-house telematics platform from using an external platform. How are you seeing the consumer adoption of that? Beyond trial periods, are you satisfied with the take rate? I guess that people are subscribing to those kinds of services.
Gosh, you're opening up a big one. One, I'm never satisfied because I don't think we've ever reached it, and that's part of the Kaizen approach to it. We always need to get better.
Right.
So no, I'm not. However, where we are today has exceeded the expectations that we set for ourselves. Some of the internal metrics of connectivity and subscriptions, and so we've exceeded the original expectations. So the question is that because the system's better or our expectations were too low? I mean, we can go back and forth on this. Uh-huh. My point is, I think where we are right now is actually on the right growth curve and the right learning curve.
Looking, you know, a few years down the road from now, as you know, we're getting more and more software-defined vehicles out there, and you know, features being available as over-the-air updates or you know, things that you subscribe to, you know, do you see that as being a significant part of Toyota's revenue stream going forward? I guess, you know, what kind of feedback are you seeing from consumers about their willingness to subscribe to features?
Okay, well, I don't know. When we talk about words like significant revenue, I would say this. The idea of software first, you probably heard us talk about it in the Toyota Lexus line, where you're taking a software first approach, is clearly part of our going forward strategy. Two is, you have, I think there's a difference between the consumer's expectations, or what is their expectation of, you know, required in a vehicle that they believe should be purchased price, and then there's other than the optional that are services. So I think the first is to really understand from the consumer's point of view, what is the table stakes? That to me is a little bit of that I think we're still trying to figure out from the industry level. What must a vehicle have as part of just the purchase of a vehicle, and what is then more of an optional or an upgrade to what you want out of your vehicle? No different than when you have, if you buy a streaming service, or do you need, how many streaming services do you need for your TV? Do you have Disney Plus and Apple TV and Roku? And I'm making it up now. The question is each individual wants to have the basics covered. That's right now where both Toyota and Lexus, as well as industry, is trying to figure that out. And that's going to be who can listen to the customer best to provide that. And that's what we're working on right now.
So let's take, for example, something like Teammate.
Okay.
A feature like Teammate.
But now you're switching over from connected services to autonomous features.
But where I'm going with this as a feature that you would subscribe to. So you look at Tesla as an example. You know, they build in the hardware for their so-called self-driving system on every vehicle, and then you can purchase that as an over-the-air software update.
Got it. I got it.
Or you can subscribe to it. Do you think consumers are going to be interested or willing to pay for a feature like Teammate as a subscription, as opposed to, I bought the car with this hardware on it, I expect to be able to use it?
I'm going to tell you at this point, it's too early to tell. Okay. And that's part of what I think we need to research. Not research, we need to learn more. I believe there's a value to Teammate that has a value proposition or a cost. There's a cost, and there's a value proposition to the customer. Whether that becomes an optional as a service or included as a hardware expectation is what I was saying a little bit earlier.
Right.
That is really where we're trying to draw a line and figure out, what do we know this is? Because you need to have, right? You need to have critical mass on what is an expectation. You know, today, let's go to some of the basics of airbags in your car. Mm-hmm. Well, today you can't charge for how many airbags.
Right.
Because it's the expectation that airbags are there for the, okay. Well, every service that's provided, at some point people are going to be like, I think that service is just supposed to come with my vehicle. I want to turn my radio on and it plays. Right? Mm-hmm. Well, what apps am I getting to use in my car? So the answer to that question regarding Teammate or anything else like that has to be decided by the customer value.
Okay.
All right, I think we're out of time.
All right.
They got me on a treadmill for the next 2 hours.
Okay. Just any last thoughts that you want to share about Toyota?
I think that where we're at for both Toyota and Lexus as part of in this industry is you have a significant number of companies making very large strategic decisions for long term. Uh-huh. if you look at every day, there's somebody who wants to make a statement in the, you know, through your publication or anyone else's, right? They want, everybody wants it. And I think you have a lot of speculation. I still believe in the history of American economics is listening to the customer. And I think those who listen to the customer, this is not one company or a government telling us what to do. This is about what is the customer's value proposition will win the day. And while I'm confident both Toyota and Lexus is, I think that's what we do better than anybody in the industry.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, buddy.
Thanks, John.
Appreciate it. Anytime.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.